Welcome to the Electric Bastionland audio commentaries. This is episode 1, where I'll be introducing Electric Bastionland, what it is, and where it came from. I'm Chris McDowell, and today I'm joined by Rowan, Rook, and Deckard, known for their one-page RPGs such as Trashkin and Crash Pandas, and their many-page RPGs such as Unbound, Spire, and the upcoming Heart. They are the Black Eyed Peas of RPG design. Welcome Grant Howitt, Chris Taylor, and Mary Hamilton.
Hello.
Bagsy Fergie.
Thank you.
Damn it.
Are you happy with that comparison?
Oh, yeah. That's
can
fine.
Can we all
me,
be
yeah.
Fergie?
Yeah, it's an all Fergie
yeah,
Black
okay.
Eyed Peas
yeah,
ultimate
be
universe.
Fergie.
Yeah. Great. So like I said, we've got Grant, Chris, and Mary with us today. Would you mind just going over perhaps your relationship to Electric Bastionland?
Very well. I'll start. My first relationship with Electric Bastionland is I played Into the Odd in, I think, 2015 at a convention in America. And I thought it was really cool. And I picked up a copy of it about a year later on. I'd sort of been following along development, which I thought was cool. And then Chris McDowell got in touch with me one day and was like, hey, how does Kickstarter work? And then I shoved him towards Mary.
There was a lot of shoving towards Mary in this one, I think.
Yes, my job within Rowan, Rook and Deckard is to understand the spreadsheets. So, you know, I was aware of Into the Odd. I probably play and read fewer RPGs on average than either of my colleagues here. But I was aware of it, respected it, quite like Chris. Yeah. It's a good game. And when Chris sent over the ideas and the work that he'd done up to the point where we got involved, I was really excited. I think it's a really awesome system and something we'd be really proud to help out with.
Yeah, because Into the Odd was a really fun game, so it was nice to sort of get in the new era.
Mm. I think it syncs up a lot with our design goals as well in terms of being very crisp.
Skip to the fun part, style of roleplay.
Mm. Yeah, very
absolutely.
Much so.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why I think I sort of approached you guys. I've got to give credit to my friend Jonathan, who put me in. Well, he actually put me in touch with the podcast first of all, the Hearty Dice Friends podcast. Mm.
You were still like, "Hey, I want these guys to run my business for a while."
Well, it's a really sort of weird set of coincidences. So I met Jonathan through a sort of weekly club that's on in Manchester. Roleplay games and stuff, but the he recommended the podcast just because we were talking about, you know, RPG podcasts we listen to, and I think maybe the first episode I listened to, you mentioned Into the Odd I think you were talking about like the Faraway Tree or something, and you were saying like sort of offhand like, oh, I'd, you know, if you were running something in the Faraway Tree, you just use a really simple system, something like Into the Odd. So I thought, oh, cool, that's great. I didn't know these guys had heard of this game. And then When the reality of running a Kickstarter sort of started to hit reality, I thought, who do I know who maybe has a positive relationship with Into the Odd and also knows how to make a book happen on Kickstarter? And yes, it was a very, very fortunate set of circumstances. Mm. Yes, definitely. I think after dealing with this, I'm definitely glad to have had, I'm sorry, Grant and Chris, but I'm going to say, especially Mary's guiding hand.
Oh, Mary. No, I get it, man. Don't worry, that's fine. We just wrote the books.
We're ideas, men.
Bless you.
Yeah, exactly. You're those the two guys from the Black Eyed Peas that I can't name.
Yes. Yes, that's us.
Yeah. Yes, I get to be the Fergie.
Damn it.
Hang on. Well, unfortunately, there's four. So there's Will I Am, who I don't think either of us are. There's Apple the App, and then a fourth man.
I think I'm that fourth man.
That fourth guy.
I'd love it if he was just called Fourth Guy. That's
there are four. Carry on talking. We'll look at the Black Eyed Peas, okay?
Yeah. So this is the Black Eyed Peas podcast. all the greatest Black Eyed Peas commentary. What I'm going to do is I'm going to close this rambling intro. And we're going to move on to the main section of the commentary. What one of the first things I wanted to talk about with regards to Electric Bastionland was the overall concept of the game. And I think it's something that, like we touched on already, hopefully has some sort of similarities to especially what RRD have done with Spire. And one of the sort of mantras that I had was low on rules, low on lore, but high on flavor. Mm. And it's that kind of distinction between flavor and lore, if you like, or setting. When I think of lore and setting, I think of maps and timelines and family trees and some things that could be really fun to look through as a sort of coffee table book. And you know, paragraphs of history, which can be fun to write in a kind of self-indulgent way. But when it comes to role-playing games, I think flavor is something quite distinct. Is that something you guys have sort of thought with Spire?
The second you start putting in timelines, you start just making it boring, in my opinion. And like one of the things I adore about Bastionland that we've tried to do a lot with Spire and things is the lore comes through the classes. And your failed careers, there's a lot of like world building in like 10 words and in what in the abilities they get and the who they're in debt to and what items they have. That's where a huge chunk of world building comes from.
Yeah, with the I mean, I'll get into the sort of history a bit later on, but one of the goals with the original Into the Odd, so the game that predates Electric Bastionland, one of my goals with that was to have, if I could, just to have no setting information, to see if I could imply everything through. So equipment list is a really easy one, because if you put, I mean, people use the example of D&D, saying that if you put holy water and steaks and garlic on the equipment list, that tells you something about the world. It tells you that you can reasonably expect that there are vampires around. And I wanted to take that a bit further and see how much I could imply about a world without having a sort of page of setting information. Now, I did cave in and put a page of setting information in that original book. So I didn't quite
get a whole page?
A whole A5 page, yeah.
Why do you think flavor is more important than lore, Chris?
I think flavor can't really exist on its own, I think, is the thing. Like, anyone who has tasted Vanilla Essence will know this. Or if you have the coating of the crisp without the crisp. Flavor is there to latch onto something, and that something is the actual game. So you've said about classes being a good example. I think, to look at a comparison to Spire... I think you could reasonably look at the, 12 classes in Spire?
Nine, I think.
Oh, nine. Ah, okay. So even tighter than I was thinking, you could look at those nine classes and you almost wouldn't need to read the rest of the book.
We encourage people not to.
No, absolutely. and I mean, at the front of the one of the first pages of Electric Bastionland says that the players do not need to read the rules. And I think it's something that often gets overlooked. So what I was trying to say, sorry, is flavor has to connect to the game. So it's the stuff that sits on top of the game, whether it's the rules, the equipment, the characters themselves. Whereas if it's just lore, it's something that sits on its own. So that's when you've got a big paragraph of text about why the king built this city 1,000 years ago and what happened after that. It's separate to the game, and it's its own thing. And it, to me, it just doesn't tend to matter once you get to the table.
I suppose it doesn't interlock with the actions of the players. Well, the thing that we've always strought to do is to make sure that the majority of our setting info has mechanics strapped to it. Like trying to communicate things through that. And I suppose, I think something which Bastionland shares with Spire and shares with all of our work is that it only exists if it's at the table.
Yes, absolutely. And I think one of the other tenets that I have in my long list of tenets that I have to keep reminding myself about is design for the table. And it's like designed for the game table, not the coffee table, I guess. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that, you know, I love some of these big coffee table books, and they're great to look through. And I'm not saying I'd want every book to be like this, but I felt like there was a gap in the market almost. I know it sounds very mercenary, but there was a gap in the market for something that was extremely rules light, but still had a lot of that flavor. And it was flavor rather than lore. So a big book that wasn't just half a novel with a bit of game attached.
Yeah, because a lot of the sort of more rules light things tend to be more generic. So yeah, they can absolutely do more things. And kind of casting a game in a certain light and giving you a very obvious but interesting plot, whatever you're doing, like with debt in Bastionland, is a really nice way of kind of funneling that flavor towards people's mouths.
Yeah, and it's basically all there to get the game to happen, to get the game to happen and then the world to come alive, with minimal sort of barrier to entry. Because I mean, how many D&D threads are there on Reddit asking how to start their adventure? Sort of, do I start in a tavern? Do I start in a dungeon?
There's actually an entire subreddit for it.
So, yeah, I'm sure.
Quite a few.
And that sort of the whole idea of keeping it light, it's about the barrier to entry being super low. And again, this isn't saying that it's wrong to ask a lot of your players, but I think a lot of role-playing games traditionally ask a lot from their players. Whether that's literally a lot of sitting down and creating a character and learning lots of rules and mechanisms, or maybe they're asking them to really sort of get involved with the world ahead of time. And I wanted to just remove all that so someone could sit down and they almost had no choice but to discover the world just by making a character. So if you make your character and you end up with a, let me think of an example, the counterfeit taxidermist. If you get that background, that failed career, it tells you something about the world. In the same way as with Spire, if you get the hyena priest, what are they called?
Carrion priest.
Carrion priest, that's right. That tells you a lot about the world that rolling a cleric perhaps doesn't.
Mm. I think that there's also the D&D requires a lot of the players in terms of making characters, but it also gives them a great deal of freedom in that your cleric can be anything, your fighter can be anything, your bard can be, and because they're so loose operating around this core stereotype, that you, by making something that's very specific, I think you can turn people off and they're like, oh, what if I get it wrong, rather than, oh, I'm just going to play a stupid paladin.
Yeah, and again, that was why I wanted to really stress the idea that these were your failed careers. Mm. So if you got the... Mary's was a muddled mixologist, the career that Mary wrote. If you have no interest in cocktails or drink and you hate bar environments, you could still get that as your failed career and just roll with it and say, right, well, that's my failed career. Mm. That's it. That's in my past. You've still got sort of open space to move with that character and do something a bit different with them, but you've at least got that kind of spark. And like you say, that the idea saying that, oh, well, your character can be anything, it's that crippling choice of too much openness. I think it's good to have that balance of just a little bit of a spark to restrict you just a little bit, but still keep things open for the player.
I'd like to chat to you about the rules.
Sure.
Like about like the core idea behind the rules for Into the Odd, and latterly Electric Bastionland. So it, and indeed every role playing game, draws on Dungeons and Dragons. It draws on the D20 core system, but I think Electric Bastionland is the sparest functional version of that I've seen. When you were looking over the sort of the established tropes in role-playing game design around the D20, how did you decide what to cut? How did you decide what to keep? It's probably a quicker question.
Yeah. So my original... So it's a rubbish sort of anecdote now that I tell, that the Into the Odd name comes from ODD, like original D&D.
Okay.
And I think that sometimes gets misconstrued that it was like a hack of OD&D to start with. Mm. Sort of, so before even AD&D or basic D&D. And it it draws on that, and I wanted to try and get some of that feeling of a very minimal, to be honest, almost kind of incomplete rule set originally, because it leaves lots of space open for rulings. Now, OD&D does that in a very confusing way, and it doesn't make it very accessible to people. And I would argue that a lot of people are just making their own systems around it. But I wanted to capture some of that feeling, if not the mechanics. So the sort of model I was looking at originally, have you ever played a or seen a game called Searchers of the Unknown?
No.
So Searchers of the Unknown is a one-page role-playing game. You should be familiar with it, really.
I do write every one-page role-playing game.
Yeah, you claim to be the the baron of one-page role-playing games. The premise that it has is that in sort of old D&D modules, you'd have a tiny little stat block for monsters. So it would have their hit dice, armor class, move, and damage. And I think that was it, just like four things. And it tried to say, could you run D&D if the player characters also just had those bits of information? They had nothing else. And it sort of, it makes a one-page role-playing game out of that. And it's really interesting to play because it's so minimal. I'm not saying you're going to throw out all of your big role-playing game books and run a 10-year campaign using it. But it was, to me, it was really interesting to see what players did when we used that system. And what they did was they really engaged with their equipment. They really engaged with their environment. They didn't bother looking at their character sheet because there was nothing really there other than whatever weird things they'd picked up. So for me, the thing that I wanted to keep, I knew that I wanted to keep the focus on equipment. And I wanted to move away some of the focus from the characters, the mechanical element of the characters at least. So obviously the things that got the chop were classes, levels, races. I just wanted to have people be more engaged with what they got. So if you got your starter package of a pack of marbles, some glue, and an axe, they're your sort of things that you're thinking about. Really, it's that kind of like, this is a very English reference, but the old TV program Nightmare, where you had your knapsack of stuff, and that's basically all that they had to solve problems with. I'm not going to try and explain Nightmare for the US listeners. They can go to YouTube and search for Nightmare.
And be very confused, yes.
Yes, definitely.
Chris and I ran Nightmare Live back at university many years before the concept of Nightmare Live was a thing. We duct tape a Viking helmet to a bin, put it on the Sun Go search.
Wow.
I think there was a game in there as well, but...
There was an excuse for us to do accents and things.
You talking about like the equipment in games as like a focal point. Every time that I've attempted to try and run Dungeon Crawl Classics, everybody's always just hoping to get a cow or a chicken as their equipment.
In
the starting bit. And it's true, like when you're at that level, like the equipment becomes suddenly very interesting and can change complete characters depending on what they've got access to.
It's
so much fun to play at that level.
That was always the thing that disappointed me about 3.5, because like you were saying earlier, Chris, about how there's holy water and steaks and garlic, like vampires are implied. And I remember like making my first level character and be like, oh wow, holy water, I'd love some. Oh yeah, I'll get some holy water. And it does precisely fuck all against anything.
Well, it's
basically useless.
Exactly, and this is the problem with having a system like, I'm not going to sit here and rag on 3rd edition D&D for the entire length of this, but I think that the problem you have with that system is that's a system that's designed to be very balanced to various degrees. So I think what they don't want is that they don't want that system to be a system where you can buy holy water, throw it at a vampire and kill the vampire, despite the fact that that's exactly what should happen, really. Like that's your expectation if you're the player and you think, well, I've got the holy water now. I'm gonna, you know, this is the solution to the vampire problem, surely. But it's a game that's not set up for that. And again, that's also the kind of thing I wanted to be able to happen in this system. So yeah, it sort of goes both ends of the scale as well, because the other big thing that I removed from the system was magic, essentially. So there's no classes, so there's no spellcasters. But what I wanted was for everyone to have the feeling of being a wizard, where you've got all these weird abilities and you never know what you're going to end up with in when you've played the character for a year. You know, maybe they're going to be some utterly bizarre god with all these crazy abilities. I didn't want that to be something that people had to decide on at level one. So I created, at the time they were called Arcana, and now they are Oddities. Basically, if it's a spell, put it in an item. And it seemed almost too simple to work, and there were definitely some finesse to getting them right so that they don't just become too useful. But yeah, that was the other main thing that I removed, and it keeps that sort of focus on equipment, so that I wanted, when people were looking down at their character sheets, I wanted them to feel like they were almost looking into their backpack for things they could use to sort of overcome the obstacles in front of them. So in terms of the inspiration from old D&D, that's something that I've wrestled with a bit in Electric Bastion Land, because Into the Odd was designed to be roughly compatible with kind of basic D&D stuff, in the sense that you could at least do a rough conversion of stuff over. But as I sort of, the more I played the game, the more I realized I wasn't quite playing it like a traditional D&D game. And again, I'm thinking more kind of OSR, basic D&D sort of style, really. So the main thing that I wanted to keep from there was the focus on treasure hunting in dangerous locations, but basically getting rid of pretty much everything else and forgetting about the idea of compatibility, and just keeping that focus on, you're going to go somewhere dangerous and you're going to be looking for treasure, but that doesn't mean that you have to then stick to the kind of standard fantasy, because again, there's a little bit of a missing link for treasure hunting games that aren't D&D fantasy. It feels like if you're going into a dungeon, there have to be orcs, and there has to be your mind flayers with the serial numbers filed off.
Yeah, it's always tricky, I think, as a game designer, especially if you're working in fantasy. Our big books, I think, are significantly more fantastical than Into the Odd and Bastion Land. We have much more of that. There's much more whimsy, perhaps.
Yeah, sure.
But it's always a challenge being like, well, what am I going to invert? What am I going to lose? What am I going to keep and embrace? What am I going to double down on? Because there's an element of like, well, it has to be recognizable. Like,
yes,
it has to be. You were saying earlier, you were saying you were being quite mercenary when you realised there was a gap in the market. This is literally your job, Chris.
Well, yeah, I know. It wasn't at the time, so I could have been much more idealistic back then. But when I say gap in the market, what I really mean is gap on my bookshelf.
I think, so I the thing I want to articulate here around the idea that you cannot be both artistically quote-unquote pure and also be thinking about your audience. The reason, like, nobody makes, or very few people make art in order to not show it to anybody. And in an ideal world, what you want to do is serve an audience really well. Whether you're doing that with a beautiful painting that you love to look at, or whether you're doing that with an RPG, is almost sort of beside the point. It isn't just something that people are doing in a very sort of selfless way and hoping that somehow money falls out. There is a balance to be struck here, and I would say this because I'm the mercenary sort of side of this, but I think there is a valuable and important thing here about how, like, thinking about what does the world already have in it, and then how do I add usefully to that? How do I create something that maybe serves a need that people have that isn't being well served? How do I create something that is new and interesting and different? And that brings people joy, and that they feel is valuable enough to pay for. I don't think those things and those instincts are incompatible with how do I create the most fantastic expression of my art possible.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a game that I want to have on my shelf, definitely. But I think there's no better feeling for me than when someone tells me they've picked up the game and they like it. And that's not going to happen if I make something that no one's going to read. I think it's interesting because Into the Odd was sort of the first game that I did that got any sort of traction, if you like. And I think the D&D connection really helped that. Because this was back in the days when, before Google Plus exploded quietly, there was quite a large sort of community on there for like
everything happened quietly on Google Plus.
Oh, I'll stand up for Google Plus till the day I die. I think, but the quietness was quite good because you had sort of small little niche communities in there, and the fact that I could say yes, this is a type of D&D, technically. It's got HP, it's got strength and dexterity. I think that helps to get things started. I think if I had started off with Electric Bastion Land and I removed any sort of connection to D&D, like if I'd renamed all the ability scores and if I didn't use HP, I called it stamina or defensive points or something, I think it would have been much more difficult to get it into people's consciousness, I think. It's always a balancing act, isn't it? And I think as long as you're not being dishonest about it, like I have a genuine affection for those old stars of D&D. It's a very mixed affection, but there's definitely some affection there. So I think as long as it's genuine, it's not too much of a sellout.
Fair.
So the other thing that I wanted to just briefly cover is, you're going to sit back and strap in for a history lesson, because I know that's what you guys were all excited about.
That's what we signed up for. And loosen my straps.
Be careful you don't get thrown out of the history coaster.
I just wanted to quickly go over the sort of the background of the project, really, and where it started and how it sort of turned into what it is today. So just for reference, we're having this discussion at the end of March 2020, the longest month in history. But if you can cast your minds back to the idyllic times of 2011, I think that was about when I started work on Into the Odd. I found a blog post talking about Project Odd that I did back then. And that it's interesting looking back at your sort of your first posts about these sorts of projects, just to see how much sort of stuck around. And surprisingly, there's quite a lot in there that's still relevant to the game, but quite a lot that's changed as well. And one of the things that I wanted to do early on was this idea of a game for anyone, not everyone, which does sound like absolute meaningless marketing crap. But the sort of the meaning I was trying to get out of it was that anyone could play this game, but it's not going to be everyone's new favorite game. It doesn't need to do everything. It doesn't need to replace Pathfinder. It doesn't need to replace Dungeon World.
You can't please everyone all the time.
No, exactly. And it's good that there are a variety of games, but this was meant to be a game that anyone could sit down and play, even if they play it for a couple of hours and never come back to it, which isn't the ideal target to be going for. But that was the original idea. And
counts.
Yeah. So I sort of dabbled around with that system for, I think it was about 4 years. And then in 2014, 3 years. 2014 was the print release of Into the Odd, which just got a little A5 booklet release. 48 pages, I think, very kind of trimmed down. So the natural sort of first step after that would be a supplement for Into the Odd. Now, this is interesting because am I right in thinking that Strata was your first supplement for a book that you've done?
Yes.
Kind of.
It's the first full-length one. We had Black Magic.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Book of Masks.
Spire.
That was a little extra sort of
Book
thing.
Book of Masks. Yeah, there's some little bonus stuff. But Strata was the big sort of... the first hardback, source spec. Why? What's your point, Chris?
My point is, I don't want to coin the phrase of the difficult second album, but did you guys find Strata? And I mean, I know you didn't write most of it yourselves, so maybe that's the key.
Wow.
Yeah, that does make it a lot easier, honestly.
Did you find it conceptually a more difficult project than the original book? I'm aware it sounds like I'm trying to lead you down a certain avenue.
By all means, tell me truthfully. Chris Taylor, could you talk about how nightmarishly difficult it was to write Spire?
Yeah, Spire was hell itself to write.
I think that was our second album.
Yeah. Because bear in mind that these two had written Unbound together before.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, and Spire went through so many rewrites and complete throwing out the windows that honestly writing Strata wasn't as difficult as writing just the base book, because it was all just like more ideas that we'd had. In some cases for certain parts of the world stuff we put in there, it was ideas we'd already had but didn't have that kind of interesting nugget that we could base a campaign around. It was just sort of put to one side while we worked on the bits that we really, really got straight away, and then it gave us time to build on it later.
Yeah, so it was kind of if page count was a non-issue, you could almost argue that everything that's in Strata could have been in Spire.
Everything but the classes. Mm-hmm. The classes were completely separate, but everything
we struggled with those. Oh, my toes. Oh, it was like pulling teeth.
One of them still doesn't quite work.
Inksmith's good though. Play an Inksmith. Yeah. I think there is a with role playing games. It's both a blessing and a curse to try and do the second part of a project, because you've got a lot of expectations of you, especially if your first game's done well and if people are excited. Then you've got standards to upkeep, and you have to sort of write to that same tone and style as well. But also, because it's a role-playing game, you have the structure in place, you have the rules, you have the feel of the thing, and it carries itself far easier. Like the parts of Strata which we found easier to write were like a lot of the mechanics, a lot of the describing of the world, a lot of the small details which would have taken us a while beforehand, we knew how to do it by then.
Yeah, I think the what's interesting about the difference between, because obviously the parallel I'm trying to draw is when I had put out Into the Odd, I knew that I wanted to do a supplement, but there wasn't sort of an obvious thing to do. And I think with Spire and Strata, you can sort of, like I say, you could almost take them together as one giant book, and it makes sense broadly. Yeah. Whereas Into the Odd was all about distilling things down, making things small, and trying to fit everything into one tiny little pocket-sized book. So other than just writing more dungeons and more environments, there wasn't a natural thing to do. So it went the idea of a Into the Odd supplement went through a few changes. Originally, I was thinking of doing a similar size book to the Into the Odd, but one for Bastion, one for Deep Country, and one for the Underground. So doing a separate little book for each section of the world, and just having like a library of additional content that was too stupid to put in the main book. So I had things like the idea of putting in sort of running a business and leading an expedition off into the Deep Country, and all these ways that you could change the game so that it felt different. But it didn't feel, I started doing it and it just didn't feel right. I wanted to keep the main thing. And I wanted to keep it as a game where you have your character and you go on an adventure into somewhere dangerous. So I didn't want it to become Business Simulator, really. I didn't want it to become leading an army. It could be a fun thing to do, but I wanted to keep things where they were in terms of the concept. So
there's something quite attractive about the idea of writing a role-playing game that's done.
Yeah,
like that's something which we found when we wrote Unbound, which is a generic role playing game. It's like it's got world building sort of in the character building and the plot, all sort of everything rises up together, and trying to write expansions for that, trying to write additional content. I think that we were signed up to do some because of the stretch goals for the Kickstarter. But after that, there was very much the feeling, I don't know whether you agree with me here, Chris, that it was done, it was finished.
Yeah, it was a single packet.
Mm.
Like, when you haven't got any new areas to detail, and thus new classes to go into, because they created in the game, it's done. And it was weird trying to think of extras to kind of tape onto the side.
Mm. I think I can see a lot of similarities with Bastion Land. Like you can generate some more stuff which has flavor, but from a rules point of view, it's all there. Like so much of the game is here's the core of it, make it up as you go along, and. Yeah. Putting on additional rules that aren't making it up as you go along is almost betraying that core idea.
Well, it's the problem with expansions. Yeah, if you live by the sort of if you live by the philosophy of teach a man to fish, it's no good then opening a fish selling business because you've done yourself out of the business. Yeah. And the idea with Bastion was that I didn't want to have sort of a giant library of content. I wanted it to be like, here you go, I can make this stuff up or you can make it up, and it's going to be just as good if you make it than if I make it. So it's...
Teach a man to fish and then sell him beautiful coffee books, yes. Coffee table books about fish.
Pictures with him fishing in it.
Absolutely. The way that things, the situation I found myself in, like you're saying there, is that it was finished basically, and I could just create supplements that had weird things that just got bolted on, but it didn't feel right. I couldn't get behind that sort of passionately. So I thought the natural thing to think would be, oh well, you know, I could do a second edition, but I didn't want to do that because I was still pretty happy with the core of it. There weren't rules I wanted to change, so it moved over to, what could I do? Is there a way I could have a different take on this? And Into the Odd was meant to be very small and portable, and you pick it up and it's ready to go. It's got a sample adventure in there. It's a one-stop, shop, and it's there. But I thought if I did have more page count and I just wanted to amplify the bits that people liked about Into the Odd, what could I do? And in Into the Odd, there were 60 starter packages that you got for a new character. So when you rolled a character, you checked their highest score against their number of HP on a table, and that might give you three items. So you might get a set of armor, a rifle, and a hound. And then it's up to you to, that's all you get. It's up to you to decide what your character is based on that equipment. And some of them would sort of suggest a certain character background, but it was never made explicit. So for example, if you had a pair of shackles, you could be a bounty hunter, you could be a freed slave, you could be a jailer. There's a number of things that you could be, but I didn't want to say this is what you were. And I thought a slightly different approach on that was to have more of them, basically. And it started off almost as a joke, where I was like, how much could I explode this this table of starter packages? Could I have 100 of these failed careers? Okay, let's have a look. And could I give each one of them two tables with six results on, so that there's potentially, 3,600 different combinations? I'm not going to do the maths in my head. A lot. Yeah, lots of different combinations. And then as I started to fill it in, I can't remember which the first one I came up with, but I just realized this was a really useful way to project the setting, because even though you're only going to use one of these out of the 100 plus in your game, and if you got four players you can use four of them, but it was an interesting way of just having the whole setting be tied in to these failed careers. So that became the main chunk of what would then become Electric Bastion Land. And the good thing about having page of rules that fit on a two-page spread is that there's really no excuse for not including the rules. So it moved from being a supplement to being a standalone game. And yeah, we're left with what we've got today.
I suppose one thing I'd like to talk to you about. So one of the things that I struggle with is we get the idea for a class down, and so I like to think that the classes are the core of our games, because they're honestly the most exciting bit of a role playing game as far as I'm concerned. And we get the concept down. We're like, yeah, cool, okay. So we got it's this guy, and he does these things, and then. What lengths did you take? What sort of tricks or tips do you have for coming up with that many fucking things?
Yeah, so luckily, I read today on Twitter, I saw, let me make sure I got this right, someone was posting an article and I was sure it was made up. And then I went to Wikipedia and the Wikipedia link suggests it's true. You know, I'm taking it with a pinch of salt, but it was, what were they called? Ornamental Hermits?
Those
guys. Yeah, like, I'd not heard of this, but the fact is, there were just a lot of weird jobs back in the day. And there are many, many lists around there of, you know, crazy Victorian jobs or even, like, medieval jobs. Like, things that just imply a very interesting background. So ornamental hermits were, as far as I'm aware, sort of people that were paid to live on like a noble's estate and just live there as druids and wander around
and to look as crazy as possible. There's still careers that exist now that are bonkers, like mudlarkers. Your job is to sift around in the Thames. Like, that's not only incredibly dangerous but probably not that nice.
No, and I did take a lot of inspiration from real careers, but then I think I just also just made a giant list of words. just words that I like. How can I fit this in here? How can I fit taxidermy in? It's a great word. And it's just a weird concept. There wasn't really a process. It was just a bit of a marathon. So there were a few times when I went through and realized I'd essentially written the same one twice. With slightly different phrasing.
Just give it another name, it's fine.
Yeah, so yeah, I ran it through the thesaurus and called it a day. So I think I got most of those weeded out, but the actual careers themselves were relatively straightforward because it's low commitment. If you just ask me to come up with a list of 100 names and that's all the work, I'm like, okay, fine, done, I can do that. And then when the hard work comes of creating the two questions and then six answers for each question, and all the equipment. And it turns out I have a very limited set of ideas because it's very depressing when you go through and think, oh, have I used this item before? And you search for wheelbarrow and I'm like, yeah, this game is too wheelbarrow heavy. I've given too many people wheelbarrows.
It's a wheelbarrow-centric culture.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the other thing is chewing gum is the one thing that I allowed to be in multiple careers, really.
That's very funny, though. Well done.
Well, there's a list somewhere of 100 gum flavors that I put out, but I just thought I'd put some of them in. But the equipment was the real tough bit, and there was a lot of scouring of like hardware shops because I wanted some of them to feel a little bit useless and a little bit like this is just a joke item, but I didn't want I didn't want that to be all of it. If you got like a joke item, I wanted it to potentially have some use. And tool websites are good for that. Just looking through like joke shops and just finding like weird item shops is a good source of ideas for that.
Strong tip.
The stretch goals that we had, the top three stretch goals for the Kickstarter campaign were all linked to Roan, Rook and Deckard. Mary was the only one whose stretch goal was hit. Mm-hmm. And
we
ended up with Mary's career, failed career rather, which was the muddled mixologist. Would you like to talk a little bit about your inspiration for that career, Mary?
I was in two minds as to whether to go for a journalist, which is my own former career, or a mixologist, which is the thing that if money was no object, is the thing that I would have quite liked to have a go at. There was already a journalist in the book, so that made that easy. So what I tried to do was think about different kinds of cocktail and think about the sort of nightlife that a bartender would have been involved in, and the sorts of things that you might be able to create in that sort of world where everyone's a little bit of a wizard.
Cool. Well, this is I sort of put in cocktails as a sort of a theme in the game, because I am a cocktail enthusiast myself, and the sort of the setting of sort of early 20th century implies cocktails. So there's a random cocktail generating table. So I'm amazed that I didn't have one in there already. So I was incredibly pleased when I saw you come through with this career. So Grant and Chris, your stretch goals weren't hit. Now, I know for a fact that you won't have done any thought about what your failed career would have been. Is that right?
I had one.
Oh.
We had vague ideas. We were ready. Yeah. We prepare for stuff.
We were ready to rock. I had my two D6 tables all lined up. Oh,
I did not have that.
No, I didn't have that. I had the idea.
So, Chris, what was your... Did you have a rough idea of what you would have done, what we could have won?
I wanted to do a milliner. I wanted to do somebody who made hats.
Oh, nice.
Partly because a lot of the art has hats in it.
Yes.
Which I love how bizarre they are, and I wanted to do the person who made those. But also, like, I grew up on Alice in Wonderland, and I wanted to bring some of that. And there was a comic, I can't remember when it came out, but called Hatter Madigan.
Right.
Which was about the bodyguard to the Queen of Wonderland, who was the Mad Hatter, and had like these like horrid spider arms of metal in his hat and all sorts of weird stuff. And I wanted to do somebody who essentially was off his nut on Mercury with a range of deadly hats.
Ah, well, nice. I didn't give, again, I'll talk about this more in the next episode with Alec, but the art direction, I wanted Alec to be very open to do whatever he needed to do. I wanted him to... Yeah. Find a sort of find his own direction, which sounds like I didn't want to do the work of briefing him properly. But one of the few pieces of direction I gave him, so one of them was I wanted lots of animals everywhere that you wouldn't normally expect to see in, say, Victorian London, and mm-hmm. I also wanted lots of hats with the two pieces of direction.
I wanted to make those hats.
Well, now I know what I can do for the supplement to this book. We'll just get you to write 50 new careers based around hats.
Just hats.
Yeah, we'll just do that. It'll be fine.
into the hat.
Yeah, there is a random electric hat generation hat table in there as well.
Yes.
Cool. Grant, did you say you had a rough idea of what you were going to do?
Yeah. So talking of gaps in the market, elf impersonator.
Oh, I remember now. Yeah, you did say.
I really like the idea of this being a fantasy kingdom without elves, or like maybe there are elves, but only if you roll the elf impersonator class. And so you'd have things like, well, what kind of elf did you pretend to be? And you've got like, okay, so I've got, I was a high elf, so I have a fancy dress and a crown. I was a wood elf, so I have a badger. Like a tree I carry around. And like you might know a little, like you might have some stage magic which you make look like elf magic, and yeah, it just sort of there's something pleasingly mundane about Electric Bastion Land, and I think I wanted to sort of embrace that by having that. Yeah, even our elves aren't real.
So essentially, it's almost like LARPing exists within the world.
It's more like drag queens, I think.
Oh, okay, cool. Oh, this
in the there's a performance element to it,
right?
And
right.
you'd go down the pub and there'd be like elf bingo and elf cabaret, that sort of thing.
Elf themed bars,
Yeah, elf theme bars, that sort of thing, and like there's an element of that sort of that fabulousness that, and like you can sort of maybe the discussion is that actually elves are just people who dress in this way because they're all people, aren't they? And so like there's perhaps a discussion to be had there. But yeah, basically the idea to make a lot of jokes about shit elves.
Nice. Well, everybody who's listening to this that didn't back the Kickstarter, you are the reason why we don't have these in the book.
Sure. Yes.
Yeah.
I blame you.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Cool.
My imaginary children are going hungry now.
And your imaginary elf impersonators.
Yeah.
Great. So, did you guys have any further points on Electric Bastardland, or are we done?
I think I'm all pointed out.
Likewise.
It's good.
Lovely.
Yeah, it's good. You should buy it, but you probably have bought it if you're listening to this.
Buy it again.
There's always opportunities to buy it again.
Play it, mm-hmm. and then tell Chris about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, even better. Mm.
Come up with your own fail career if you think you're such hot shit.
And for those who are interested...
Sorry, I don't know why I got quite...
since you've just insulted people so much, if people did want to still buy your games in spite of this outburst...
You can go to rrdgames.com on the internet. That will redirect you to rowanrookanddeckard.com because no one can spell rowanrookanddeckard.com. We should have thought of that when we came up with our name. But, you know, planning is for losers. Mainly that. You can also follow Grant at GS Howard on Twitter, me at Newsmary on Twitter, and Chris. Chris, what's your name on Twitter?
Nobody
well, that's
knows.
The problem.
The Madigan.
You don't go there.
Chris is actually Madigan, aren't you?
I am.
Yeah,
the Madigan.
named after said Hatter Madigan, presumably.
Mm. Yep.
I believe Chris is trying to be aloof or perhaps mysterious.
I just
not
think
just
extremely
unengaged.
Distant.
Yes.
Let's go with mysterious.
Oh yeah, mysterious.
You can also listen to the Hearty Dice Friends podcast on your favourite podcast platform. Yeah. And there's a Discord associated with that and some Twitter activity and some nice people that you can come hang out with if that's a thing that floats your boat.
Yeah.
Lovely. Well, thank you, Mary, Chris and Grant. And you can, if you are listening to this still, despite all this, you can join me again on the next episode where I will be joined by Alec Sorensen and we will be talking about the art behind Electric Bastion Land.
Lovely, lovely. Pictures.
Say goodbye, everyone. Goodbye.
Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye,
everyone. Bye.
I have no idea how to finish that.
No one knows how to finish podcasts. It's okay.
This is true.